Hello, and thank you for joining today's briefing. I'm Jim Doyle, President of Business Forward. We're thrilled to have Neil Katyal with us today. Neil is a partner at Hogan Lovells Law Firm, a professor at the Georgetown University Law School, former acting Solicitor General of the United States, where he was responsible for representing the federal government of the United States in all appellate matters before the U.S. Supreme Court and the courts of appeals across the nation. He has argued in front of the Supreme Court 41 times, including one just yesterday. In 2017, American Lawyer recognized him as Litigator of the Year. We've asked Neil to talk about two things. The first is the facts in his book, Impeach, the Case Against Donald Trump, to lay out the arguments in favor of impeachment. But we've also asked Neil to talk a little bit about the larger impact on rule of law. And I'm pleased to be joined by Ed Meyer, who will be moderating the call today and is running our podcast program. Please note that this call is on the record and there may be reporters present. After today's briefing, we'll send you a link to the podcast, which will also be available on our website, Spotify, iTunes, and Google Play. Neil, thank you very much. Please tell us about your book.
All right. So thank you. It's a real delight to be back with everyone at Business Forward. I've had the pleasure of being on these calls a couple times before. And this one is the first one where I'm talking about something that I've written. I've written this book called Impeach, the Case Against Donald Trump. And while that sounds like a kind of politically laden title, the book is not. And I don't think impeachment can be viewed and it should not be viewed in a political lens. In other words, like, you know, as I think Trump has said many times, impeachment's going to help him and make it easier to win the election. That may very well be true. I have no idea, but I approach these things really as a lawyer and trying to think through from the standpoint of the structure of government, what's the right answer to these questions. So when you think about what Trump what the president is alleged to have done, I think it's really profoundly worrying and kind of the heart of what the impeachment clause in the Constitution is about. So, you know, back in Philadelphia in 1787, and this is how the book opens, there were a lot of founders like Elbridge Gerry who thought there shouldn't even be an impeachment clause in the Constitution. What they reasoned were, you know, you'd have, if you're a president, you're going to run for re-election. And that should be the check on abuse. And particularly back then, when there wasn't amendment limiting the president to two terms, it was contemplated the president could have multiple reelection campaigns and the like, and that would be a check. But when Gerry said this in Philadelphia, immediately he was attacked or responded to by Madison, Hamilton, and others who said, well, what if you have a president who is in the pay or under the service of a foreign government? What would the remedy be then? And others said, like George Mason, that presidents can't be above the law, that there has to be some mechanism in place besides reelection. And that led even Gerry to say, yeah, that's right. And that's how we have this clause in the Constitution. And, you know, the kind of compromise that was done was to say the House would do the impeachment, the formal accusation, and the Senate would do the actual conviction and removal, and by a two-thirds supermajority rule. They wanted to make it hard, and they made it hard by using that phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors is the phrase, to signal this has to be pretty serious stuff. It can't just be jaywalking or something like that. But it doesn't also have to be criminal. That's why they used the word high before crimes and misdemeanors. That kind of signaled an offense against the state. And really, I think the paradigmatic offense against the state was, you know, when you ask, what does that mean? We had a congressman in 2008 who just gave it some flesh. He said, this business of high crimes and misdemeanors goes to the question of whether the person serving as president put their own interests, their personal interests, ahead of public service, their own personal interests ahead of public service. And that person was Mike Pence, who said that as a member of Congress back in 2008. And I do think that captures the mainstream constitutional thinking of what the phrase means. And so you then ask, you know, what is President Trump alleged to have done here? Well, essentially the allegation, I think it's more than an allegation given the transcript of the July 25th phone call between him and the Ukrainian president, is that he tried to cheat in the 2020 election. He tried to get the help of a foreign government to help him get dirt on his chief political rival, not really to get dirt, but to announce an investigation so that he could tar and feather him. And to me, that is really what impeachment's all about. And the way that I approach this is what I call the yardstick rule, which is just this idea that, you know, you tell your first year law I tell my first year law students this on day one, which is pretend the parties are reversed, because everyone comes in with biases. Some like big companies, some like the little guy. Just pretend you're making the argument on the other side. Pretend the identities of the parties are reversed. Does that change things? And so if you hear, I think, you know, the way I think about it is, imagine President Obama was alleged to have done these things. How would you feel? Would you want that to be what a president can do? And would you seek to remove him from office for that? And I think that that question really answers itself, because if you can't trust the election system, if you can say that a president can use and leverage the mighty powers our founders bestowed on the commander-in-chief, then you're essentially undoing that big check on presidential abuse, which is re-elections, because then presidents, once elected, can seek to use those powers to entrench themselves into office. So that's the essence of what the House voted for in Article 1 of impeachment. And then on Article 2, they voted for an obstruction of Congress charge, which is really interesting. I mean, we did have a number of witnesses, 18, come forward in the House and testify largely against the president, and certainly no one exculpated him. But those 18 witnesses were actually, many of them were under gag orders, because the president said if you worked in the executive branch, you weren't allowed to testify. And those folks, like Dr. Fiona Hill and Ambassador Sondland and others, gave testimony anyway. We've never had a president who's done this, who said that I don't have to cooperate with the investigation, that I can gag every witness, every employee. Literally never. Indeed, in today's Washington Post, I wrote a piece quoting President Polk in 1846, who said, once there's an impeachment inquiry, everything, even the most sensitive foreign affairs information, has to be given over to the Congress, because that is the essence of what our checks and balances is. And even Richard Nixon, for a few days, tried to block a few executive branch witnesses from providing testimony in the impeachment inquiry, but even he backed down. So we've never had this in our history, a president who said in an impeachment inquiry, I don't have to cooperate, I don't have to provide any witnesses, any documents. But that's where we are now. And just in the last 24 hours, I think we've seen a rapid velocity and turn to the investigation. And, you know, I'll close with that piece. You know, obviously today, Speaker Pelosi has appointed 7 managers. They'll be the prosecutors in the Senate. We've also seen a document release by Lev Parnas, who was a Giuliani associate, which is quite chilling, and shows that Giuliani was acting not on behalf of the president as president, but in his personal capacity, which I think puts the lie to what Trump has been saying, which is he was actually legitimately concerned about a corruption investigation in Ukraine. It just happened to be about the Bidens. It just happened to be the only time ever any country that he ever cared about corruption in was Ukraine. I mean, he was asked, name any other country ever in which you cared about corruption, and he wasn't able to name anyone. So there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical of the explanation, but no, you know, I think that that skepticism has increased a lot in the last 24 hours, given that document release. And so we will see the articles formally being transmitted to the Senate tonight, and then the trial really beginning in earnest, as I understand it, on Tuesday. And the Chief Justice will preside, and I know some of your questions will be about what's the role and what's going to happen in the trial, and I'm happy to take those. And before closing, in my opening remarks and then to your questions, I just wanted to say a word about some of the larger issues at stake here that Jim asked me to speak about, because, you know, I did have the privilege of serving as the federal government's top lawyer. And I think every person who held my job approaches this from the standpoint of justice really being blind, that literally Lady Justice is blindfolded. And the interests of the United States don't shift and change just because of the political administration changing. And probably the kind of core principle when you're a government lawyer or when you're thinking about the Constitution is this idea of checks and balances, separation of powers. And to me, that's the kind of real threat we're seeing from this president, because he thinks he's always right and that nobody should be able to challenge him. And that is, you know, why Madison in Federalist 51 said, you know, men aren't angels. They're going to make mistakes. That's why we need to have the double security of separation of powers in the three branches, why we need federalism and other things. But this is a president who, when a court rules against him, calls it a so-called judge or says it's an Obama judge or something like that. He calls the press an enemy of freedom, enemy of the state, and the like. He calls the federal bureaucracy the same thing, a deep state, and things like that. And all of these different institutions are done to avoid the concentration of power in one man. And, you know, our founders recognize you could have even the wisest person serve as commander in chief, but those checks and balances are still going to be important because, quite honestly, everyone makes mistakes. And to me, that's the big threat posed by this. You have a president who says, I can't be indicted. That's what Barr said when the Mueller report came out. He is immune because he's a sitting president. But everyone who's ever said that, every scholar who said a president can't be indicted has said the remedy has to be impeachment. So you can't indict him. So then the House tries to impeach him. Then he says he can't be impeached, that it's a coup and the like. And ultimately what we're getting to is really the opposite of the American system, which is in which one in which we the people have checks and balances and tools when we have a commander-in-chief who makes mistakes, or here who makes really more than a mistake, but commits, in my judgment, a high crime and misdemeanor. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have, and I really appreciate you all being on the call.
Thank you very much, Neil. And this is Ed Meyer joining the call here, and I'll be moderating the Q&A. If you've got a question for Neil, please email us at info@businessfwd.org, and we'll try to get to it. We've already got several questions for you, Neil, that have come in. I'm going to combine several of them together into one. We've from MC Townsend in California, and Paul in Virginia, and Brad in Washington, D.C., are all asking about the role of the Chief Justice in this trial, and specifically also about, you know, this kind of magic number of Republicans that it would take to require testimony. We hear a lot about that number being four to get to a, you know, number of 51. But the question here really is, the conventional wisdom is that it takes four, but isn't the number actually three, since Chief Justice Roberts would be the deciding vote if it was split 50-50, or the deciding decision maker? Can you talk to us a little bit about what that magic number actually is? And do you anticipate Chief Justice Roberts playing a bigger role than Chief Justice Rehnquist did in the Clinton impeachment trial? Because back then, I think both sides had agreed on the rules, but in this case, that's not the case.
Yeah, so thank you, MC, and Paul and others for such a good question. It is the case that 51 senators can control the process. Now, they can't amend the existing rules, though. That requires a supermajority. And those existing rules were written back in 1867 for the impeachment of President Johnson. And so there's already a debate as to whether those current rules permit the calling of witnesses. They very well may, in which case, what they say is that it should be decided by the Chief Justice. And so it may be that you need 67 votes in order to dispense with witnesses altogether. Otherwise, it would be a request to the Chief Justice. And it's an interesting thing, the way our founders designed impeachments. You know, impeachments are not just for presidents, but they're also for officers of the United States, which includes members of the cabinet and federal judges. It doesn't include members of Congress. Those folks can't be impeached. They can be excluded and disqualified through a separate provision in the Constitution. And normally, the head of the Senate is the person who would preside over an impeachment trial. But that's not true for the head of the Senate being the vice president. That's not true for the impeachment of the president. Our founders recognized the vice president would have an inherent conflict of interest. And so that's when the Chief Justice comes in. And the role of the Chief Justice has always been a bit unclear because we've only had two impeachments of sitting presidents before. And one, the most recent one, was, of course, President Clinton and Rehnquist being the presiding officer. And I would say, really, Rehnquist did very little. At one point, he did say that that members of the Senate function as a court and the like. But beyond that, he didn't do much. In fact, at the end of it, at the end of the impeachment hearing, he said, I did very little, and I did it particularly well. And, you know, I suspect that that is going to be an attractive way for the Chief Justice to operate where he can. On the other hand, this is a man, the Chief Justice Roberts, who's profoundly concerned with fairness and institutions and the like. I mean, I've had the privilege of arguing in front of him 41 times, and I can tell you every time he's listening closely and trying to do what's right. And, you know, I may disagree with him about what that is in terms of what's right, but I think we are lucky to have a Chief Justice like this who is going to be the grown-up in the room at a time when I think things are going to get heated. I do suspect that if the question of witnesses is put to the Chief Justice, we will see witnesses because, you know, every trial that I've ever heard of has witnesses. And the idea that the president and his loyalists in the Senate can block witnesses from coming forward, particularly witnesses who've never testified before, unlike, for example, in the Clinton impeachment, I think is hard. In the Andrew Johnson impeachment, there were 41 witnesses in the Senate trial. In the Clinton one, there were three. We've never had one with zero. And so I expect the chief to exercise some force in that regard if it comes to that. I sure hope that everyone in the Senate agrees that the American people deserve these witnesses, deserve the truth to come out. And, you know, let's have the truth come out. If they want to still justify the president's retention in office after knowing the facts, okay, so be it. But the American people should know the facts.
So, Neil, John Griffin in Victoria, Texas is asking that what's the best method of securing the testimony of John Bolton, for example, so that senators will consider his testimony during the impeachment trial. It sounds like what you're saying is that Democrats will, if they bring forward Bolton as a potential witness, that you think Chief Justice Roberts would permit that and force the hand of the Republicans to overrule that? Is that how that would play out?
So I don't want to make an absolute prediction, but, you know, John Bolton has said that he does want to testify in the Senate, so you have a willing witness. And you've got, I think, an overwhelming need for this testimony. After all, Bolton has said through his lawyers that he has new information that hasn't been revealed yet. And he did give a speech before in which he said that while working with President Trump, he realized that the president uses foreign policy to advance his own personal ends. So this is a person with extremely relevant knowledge who wants to testify. And that's why I think the president has been so scared going so far on Sunday as to say he would try and invoke executive privilege to block John Bolton's testimony. And he said he's doing it in order to protect the interests of the presidency of the United States, which is a weird thing for him to say because he doesn't operate that way. It's not as if this is someone who is sitting there saying, I have to protect the long-term interests of the president of the United States. He's rather actually done a lot of stuff in short-sighted ways to make those powers weaker, more vulnerable, more questionable. Certainly, if it did go to that and he tried to invoke executive privilege, I think that would be something the Chief Justice would look at. And I think it'd be a very tough argument for Donald Trump to win that, given the longstanding tradition that in impeachments, all material is available, because that is we're in the ultimate check situation. I mean, this is the last card the founders gave the American people to play. When you have a circumstance which you can't indict, you can't investigate otherwise, impeachment is the remedy. And to say, oh, he can block witnesses who have firsthand relevant knowledge is, I think, a losing argument every day of the week.
And I know you can't get in the mind of these senators, Neil, but Robert Kosvinsky is a former naval intelligence officer in Vermont, and you know he's asking that in addition to the sort of usual folks on the Republican Senate side that you know might consider compelling testimony, folks like Romney, Collins, Murkowski, you know, would you anticipate that some of the Senate Intelligence Committee members like Sasse or Burr might go along with trying to get additional testimony, given what they've seen potentially within their own Senate Intelligence Committee meetings?
I do. I think that's a great question because, you know, I think both sides have gotten so political and they denigrate the motives of the other side a lot. And maybe sometimes both sides are justified in that. But there's a lot of times in which we have such a bigotry of low expectations for the other party in this country. And I'm someone who thinks that people come to Washington, to my great city, to make a difference. And to, you know, they may have a different conception of what the right thing to do for America is, but they come here for that basic shared goal to make the country stronger and better, regardless of what party they're in. And I think we're approaching that moment in time when you look at the allegations against the president, you look at the new documents that just came out yesterday, you look at the fact that the president is trying to block every document and every witness from coming forward, and you have to ask, what's going on? The trajectory is not good for the president. I mean, every time there's a new witness, every time there are new documents, it's not as if they say the president's innocent in any way, shape, or form. They're always bad for him. They're always damning. And so I think with that trajectory in mind, I suspect that we will see Republican senators of all stripes, not just, you know, the kind of so-called moderates, the Romneys of the world, but others who are saying, look, you know, our job is to make sure the American people get the information they need in order to make decisions. And that requires witnesses and it requires documents.
And, Neil, what about the status of some of the other executive privilege cases that are going on right now? Are they going to impact the impeachment proceedings in any way?
I don't think so. I think that they're on slower trajectories. So, you know, there's Don McGahn with respect to the Mueller investigation, who was the president's top White House lawyer, and whether he has to testify or not. Oral argument was just held last week in that. You could get a result, but even in as I suspect, the result will come out against the president. But, you know, he's one to take everything on appeal, so he'll take it on appeal to the Supreme Court, and that may take some time and the like. So I suspect what the Democrats' strategy is here is to say impeachment allows these decisions to be ruled on by the Chief Justice, and we're very happy having the Chief Justice resolve these, not because they think that that the Chief Justice is in their pocket or anything like that. Of course not. But I think it's fair to say that if you look at the history of executive privilege, and you look at the history of impeachment, Donald Trump has an incredibly weak case. He doesn't have legal support for what he's done, which is why, you know, his White House counsel wrote an 8-page memo to Congress basically saying executive privilege and this and that. And, you know, the memo was basically written in crayon. It was not a serious legal document.
Joe Ferris in Indianapolis is asking if you still believe in the two-stage process that you and George Conway outlined for impeachment.
Well, I think it's probably being overtaken by events. We'll find out for sure in a couple of hours. But yes, in a piece that George Conway and I wrote last week, we advocated two different solutions for because the Senate hadn't agreed to witnesses. One was to just send up Article 2, the obstruction of Congress charge, and withhold Article 1 and then subpoena the testimony of John Bolton. Because the Senate appears to be moving in the direction of saying they're going to have a real trial, they're going to have witnesses, Susan Collins said she's working with a group of Republicans on that. You know, I can see the case for not just sending up Article 2, but sending them both up to get the show on the road. The other thing we said in that piece, though, I still very much believe, which is I think when the articles are transmitted to the Senate, the Speaker should formally say, you know, this isn't being being transmitted to the Senate for you guys to have some Soviet-style show trial. This is for, you know, this should be an American trial with witnesses and documents and the kind of procedures that every American expects in a matter of this gravity.
Well, Neil, that's all the time we have today. We are very grateful for you joining us here, and encourage folks to check out your book on Impeach, the Case Against Donald Trump. And we really thank you for your time. And folks should look out on your email for a post-event email and survey that will be coming your way. And please join us for future programming that we'll be doing in 2020 moving forward. So, Neil, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Real honor to be with you guys.